Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Would You Date a Scientist? I'm your host, Wendy Gannon, and I am joined today by Ben Orfarth. Welcome, Ben. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thank you very much.
Good, good. I do like to ask a second time, like, actually, how are you? Because I know it's been rubbish.
No, it's actually feeling quite okay. It's been a very relaxed morning today with my son. He didn't shout or anything. He was he slept very long even. So yeah, we only sat together for maybe half an hour for breakfast this morning.
And how most old of it is he?
He's nearly three.
Oh.
3 weeks or something in 3 weeks missing for his third birthday. Yeah.
Oh, bless him. Oh, so you've got quite a lot over the next few weeks coming up.
Yeah, we're going to see my parents and stay there for a bit. Hopefully everything works out. And then it's going to be relaxing, I hope. Yeah, sounds nice.
You. Yep, absolutely. So Ben, let's get cracking. What's your favorite piece of tech?
Oh yeah. I thought about the question for a bit. Yeah. So there's so many things to choose from. So it's a very difficult question, isn't it? So obviously I love computers and programming and so on, but is that really like the most important thing? I mean, more significant is probably, you know, things that really extended our life expectancy and really helped humanity as a whole. And that's probably medicine, I would guess. And if you look like at the last, 60 years or 50 years or something, then I was just reading a book, 10 Drugs, it's called, about the different medicines. The pill is probably one of the most significant, inventions or technological advances, I think, for humanity, because so many people so many women have entered the workforce and taken higher education, and so it has done a lot for gender equality as well as, I think, more human rights, really.
I love that. That's a great one.
Oh,
well done. I like the out of the box thinking there. No, that's a really good one. So Ben, you're working at the moment for Love Holidays as the head of data science. Mm-hmm. How did you get into data science in the first place?
Yeah, it was really at the time when I switched over, it wasn't really that obvious what you could do when you came from a research career in STEM. So it was really unclear to me what I could do. So you have this career in research that's going on, and then you don't really know where to change to. When I was in Germany visiting my parents and looking a little bit at my alternatives, I couldn't. I think at the time there was still no real knowledge of what data science is, but then I got calls from London. So in the end, I ended up in London, and it was really fortunate. So I was really pulled into it a bit, and was just really lucky, I think. But yeah, there's just so many commonalities between what you do in a STEM research career and what you do in data science. So the transition is it's not easy to the industry and to different methods and so on. But that's kind of the obvious step, I guess, when you want to switch into the industry.
Okay, where are you from originally?
Next to Mannheim, I was born in southern Germany, next to Frankfurt.
Right, I see Berlin on your LinkedIn. One of my most favorite places in the world. I've been there many, many times. My friends live there, so it's very dear to my heart.
Yeah, it's a really nice place to live. I've good memories there.
Yeah,
met a lot of cool people.
Lots of partying as well.
yeah, it's a good place for that. Yeah, definitely.
So, can you talk me through your journey of your career?
Oh yeah, sure. So in data science, I guess, right? I really started out at, coming to London for an interview, and I had this Google style whiteboard interview that went on for, 10 hours. I don't know.
Blimey.
It was really tired. Yeah, maybe I'm exaggerating, but it was really long.
That's just what it felt like.
it went on for the whole day, definitely. And, Yeah, and they must have liked what they've seen. So they asked me about all kind of things I had to kind of puzzle together, like binary trees and all these kind of questions about algorithms and so on. That one of their interests was that they needed people doing their data who also were good at programming. So we kind of went over everything. And yeah, and then I started working at a betting company. Really a great place to work at the time. I think there were 15 people, and then they grew to 40, 50 people. And then kind of yeah, I thought it was time to get into something more defined for data science. So I switched to a loan company. I had four offers. Interestingly, one was from Cambridge Analytica, and but I chose the loan company. So I think it was a good choice. I mean, yeah, it worked out, and it was a good time as well. So a lot of war stories from that time about implementing a back-end system for decision making from scratch with other people. It was a lot of fun. And then I went into a lead position then at a recruitment company. We try to give decision support to recruiters in companies who have big banks or government agencies. They have hundreds or thousands of applicants, maybe 10,000 applicants sometimes for just a few roles. And then so we help them with the filtering a bit using machine learning, then going over the CVs and figuring out the important bits and modeling who should be kind of pre-selected or rather rejected, perhaps based on previous decisions by recruiters in the company.
Interesting stuff.
Now love holidays and it's also very challenging. So we have so many different projects going on. So we're hiring at the moment sometimes to tell or the project, and people tell me, how can you do so many projects? And like the yeah yeah but I think we just have very good people and good system set up that we can be productive. It's a lot of fun.
Good, good. What's your most favorite project you've worked in the whole of your career?
Oh wow. I don't know, like there's several, I guess. So I think what I'm maybe still most proud of is that the loan company, so my second company, how I and people around me, maybe my team, I can say we built up this decision system from scratch to re-implement all decision making in the company from KYC, so looking up the customer and getting the credit reports and then making loan decisions all in one system that we can monitor and so on. So that's something I'm still proud of. So maybe that's it. It's more it's in between, I guess, really machine learning and software engineering, perhaps, but yeah, that's what I'm proud of most, I guess.
Brilliant, brilliant. So, as you know, this podcast is for those who are looking to get into data science, either through academia or pivoting from their career, which is what you did. What advice would you give to somebody who's looking to do that?
Well, yeah, so I think I mean, depending on where you're coming from, you have different weaknesses and you have to work on. So if you come from a research career, you should work on your programming or your software engineering skills. If you come from a data science master's, many people do nowadays. Then it's still maybe similar areas, or maybe statistics or something that you can brush up a bit on, things like that. What I always think it's very, very useful if you have a goal and you have a, and you make a plan and you try to follow it through. And so I need to learn about this. I need to learn about this. I need to learn about this. And then you go through it and you say, okay, today I'm going to do this, or this week I'm focusing on this, something like that. Right. And then with some deadlines or certain time scale that you work against. Yeah, we are interviewing a lot of candidates at the moment, and some of them are technically very strong, at least on the machine learning side. But then another thing that we are looking for as well is the communication skills.
Yeah,
so that people can work well in teams and they don't get defensive, and they can defend their position, but at the same time they should take in feedback. So that's something really important, because you can only if you challenge each other in a team and you can bounce off ideas, then you can get so much better in everything you do.
Perfect. That's really interesting. So as a hiring manager, what's the minimum kind of standard that you would look at for somebody applying for a position? So let's think about a pivot, maybe. Would you accept somebody who's done a data science bootcamp and it's not necessarily got that much working knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, I worked with people who were transitioning over from an analyst position, who were doing their masters, or also people who were coming over from a boot camp, and it really depends on a lot on the communication skill and the attitude of the person. So I think that's the most important thing, and the more junior, of course, the people are, the more you have to hire for potential, and then rather than any kind of thing that they can show on their CV. So it's a more difficult decision, obviously.
Absolutely.
But you have a lot of people in there already at the more junior range who did a master's in data science, or who have maybe half a year of experience. If they're very junior, it can be tough to bring them up to speed.
Yeah.
So.
What do you think would help somebody who is at that position, you know, quite junior, and there's a lot of competition at the moment, isn't there? What would put somebody above the rest of them?
Yeah. So what I said about attitude and communication skills, so that's really the thing that I would look for then on somebody's CV. Or I would look for good schools, obviously, and that they had exposure to machine learning. So that's kind of what we are focusing on. We're very machine learning focused, data science team, rather than any maybe analyst or something work. But then anything that could show that they're actively socially active, let's say, and that they have broader interests. So I think that's what I would look for.
Sure. Would it help if somebody had maybe got some open source coding and done a project in their own time on something that they're really proud of, or something that shows their passion on something? Would that really help?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, of course, if the higher the profile of that work, or the more extensive it's a big plus. I think if I see somebody has like a couple of projects there and they're like half done and so on, more kind of tutorial copy paste kind of thing, then I'm not really that impressed. But if I see somebody really did something very interesting or innovative, and then this makes a big difference. And of course, if it's on a broader open source project, then even better. Then they can show that they know how to program, know how to work in a team, take feedback, and so on. Definitely.
Yeah, I think any extracurricular stuff that you can do is always going to be a positive, isn't it?
Well, depends what it is. But yeah, I mean,
of course.
Yeah. But yeah, so but yeah, if I mean the coding stuff, of course, yeah, that can be a big plus. But I think also if somebody has done music or is organizing a football team or something,
yeah.
So that's also yeah something, yeah that shows a lot about the character as well.
Definitely, especially if you can organize a football team with machine learning.
I'm sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And what's the best piece of advice you've received in your career?
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think really at the loan company when we are looking at problems, yeah, my then boss and I, we did a lot of things together. He would tell me, yeah, okay, let's break this down and so on. So that's still something that I wasn't doing enough, and maybe still I'm not doing enough. You know, when you think like, oh, okay, this is easy, let's just do it like this and write it all up. But instead, you really want to break it down, and
yeah,
and so that's an important approach. Yeah,
I think that's an important approach for life, and I definitely don't do that. Mm-hmm. And I think if you find yourself not doing it, it's good to go back and start that again, because you'll probably forget a few steps or just take them for granted, don't you?
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So how do you think data science is going to look in the future? I used to say in 10 years, but I've stopped saying that. How do you think it's going to look, or how would you like it to look in the future?
Yeah. Yes, it's weird about the 10 years, right? 10 years can be like anything. Yeah. People, oh yeah, 10 years so far away. And yeah, I don't know. People don't know. It's really hard to know. So, all these new products coming out at the big tech companies, AWS or on Google Cloud and so on, they make it much easier. So they remove some of the technical barriers, but at the same time, it's still really important to know these things. So I think what will happen more is that there will be more data scientists, the spectrum of skills will become bigger. So there will be more people who are, maybe analysts or not as technically savvy. Maybe sometimes they're called a decision analyst. And then at the other end, you have people who are very good programmers and know the ins and outs of all kind of API calls that you have to do to resolve more difficult issues, or can implement a deep learning model from scratch.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I say this quite often, data science is kind of the umbrella of all of those things. And then it's just going to be separating out and specializing, really niching into those areas, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
absolutely. Okay, so throughout your career, and you were talking about, you know, the pill making it better for gender equality, etc. Mm-hmm. What's that looked like? What has equality looked like throughout your career?
Oh, okay. So there are not a lot of women, I think, in data science that you see at meetups. Sometimes you do see a few. So yeah, it's when there are applicants now, for example, that are women, then I take a second look to see if maybe there's still something that they have to offer that male candidates maybe wouldn't be able to offer. And of course, if there was any choice, then we would maybe go more for the woman. Just to have a more diversified team, which can perhaps help and make better decisions and have better discussions. But it's very far from being equal. I think a lot of that has to do with the interests of men and women, perhaps.
I think
that's my
I mean, so when I first started doing this podcast, I contacted lots and lots of people, and men came back to me, which was really, really interesting. I'd probably sent messages via LinkedIn to lots of men and women, and the men came back to me. I said, okay, so there's women out there. I just need to find out where to find them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you keep looking in the same places, the same people are going to be coming back to you. So I found the Women in Data Science group. You can have a look in there and advertise your roles if you need to.
And
they've come back, and 99% of the women on the podcast are from that group, which is amazing. So I think it does depend on where you're looking, what your job description says, because there are gender bias words. I think they are out there. It's just, I think also it's difficult for women to change a role if they're already in a role. I think men look at a job spec. If they can do 2 out of 10 of the things, then they'll apply.
It's true, yeah.
If women have got 9 out of 10, they won't. So I just need to keep supporting you women and letting you know that that is not how you do it. You know, if you can do half of it, let's have a conversation. I'm sure you can probably do more than half of it. It's just how it's worded, you know. What are your thoughts on that?
No, it's definitely true what you're saying. Maybe women have to overcome maybe these kind of anxieties or lack of confidence perhaps than to apply for more roles.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think the whole childbearing age as well comes into it a lot.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And a lot of people don't, you know, I'm all for having a job split into two and two different people doing it. I think if you can get parents to do half a day and another parent to do another half day, or somebody who's disabled,
that's
true.
It's not fair at all. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to get two people for the price of one, and you're going to get two different outlooks. So it's a no-brainer for me. Absolute no-brainer.
Sure.
So talking about diversity, how do you think would be the best way for us to ensure that AI is diverse or our algorithms are diverse?
It's interesting that you're asking. At my previous position, we were de-biasing these algorithms specifically.
Okay.
So we're trying to really make sure that that women and men had the same chances, or roughly the same chances. And then to be perfectly clear, it was that women shouldn't be biased against I think overall, and then but it doesn't go the other way. I found it always a bit strange. Women leaning industries, it's okay if women still have the better chances. And then also across different ethnicities as well. So that was something that we were focusing on. And for job AdWords, we also were developing tools to make sure that the AdWords were phrased in a way that was more gender neutral.
So how would somebody stop those biases? What were you doing to stop them?
You can introduce penalties basically in these algorithms that would penalize any model that has a bias. So you can basically have a lever, then it would say, okay, I want that much focus on debiasing. And in the end, you see if the bias disappears, how much it disappears, and you can up or down regulate then as a function of that.
Okay, that's interesting. Never had that before. Brilliant. So, I mean, you were talking about the data, about it being okay for women, but not okay for men. So we were talking about this in the last podcast. How are you going to de-bias data? If you think about historical data, it's all been the same. Let's just say white men, for example. Okay. Yes. And then you get to a certain point, it's like, right, we need to include everybody in the scale, not just white men. Is that why you've done that? Because you need to what's the word? That's it. I've not lost a word for ages. Here it is.
all the time.
Yeah. Because you need to make up for that past data. You know, is that why it is, or how are we going to stop that past data taking over all the future data?
Yeah. So it's I guess it's about correlation and causation, really. So what models describe typically are correlations in your data. So if you have a lot of white men, let's say, hired into a position, then the model will promote profiles with white men that are typical for white men. But of course, if you should try to equalize it a bit, or make sure that you don't feed data into the algorithm. I mean, data are what they are, but that you feed the data in a way into the algorithm that it can't take that into account so much, or that it has actively debiases that side of it.
Sure. So you could do it from this point rather than all of the data. I'm signaling a timeline with my hands on the video. So if this is the past data, then you could start at the point where all of the data was done, I suppose, couldn't you?
Well, I mean, you need to start somewhere with a model. I mean, there are different models that that it's a bit of a problem, because you have to start learning on past data always.
Yeah.
You can't just make random decisions basically and then try to learn on that. I mean, that's a way, for example, to debias. If you'd make random decisions and then try to figure out then what the real causes are rather than the correlations.
Okay.
But of course that is highly suboptimal. I mean, you'd hire the worst people basically, just by chance.
Okay. So, I mean, some people do that.
Sure. Yeah, that's true. I mean, we had some questions in there. There was if they were in a choir and things like that. Yeah, for some consultancies I think they just want to have public schools in there, public school alumni.
Naughty. And I didn't ask this question before, but you mentioned the master's degree. Do you think it's important that somebody's got a master's?
Well. There is certainly value in doing it. On the flip side, people do PhDs, and sometimes they are so much into a certain niche that they're not really good then at machine learning or programming and so on, or they just want to do the research, or they took a very different trajectory, so they have to kind of redirect a lot of things. So we have one relatively new joiner in our team who has a bachelor's degree, and he's just very, very good. It shouldn't be a requirement, definitely, but I think a master's degree certainly is an advantage.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, there. I don't think that our job description should have a degree on there, that you must have a degree. And I also don't think it should have years of experience on there.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, that's
because,
true.
Because, somebody could be doing it for 10 years and have a master or a PhD and be completely rubbish compared to somebody who's just been doing it for 2 years and learned themselves.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? So, when we designed the interview process for the data science team, I was thinking a lot about this. So standard papers, I'm sure you've heard of them, predictive validity of assessment criteria in hiring or something. And there's an update on that from, I think, 2017 and so on. But cited, I don't know, 1,000 times or more. And so years of experience doesn't have any importance at all. And but then other things have. So how quickly they can respond to some questions that you ask them, or work samples, or
I don't think we should be using CVs either, because the CV just shows you how well somebody can write a CV. I think there's lots of other ways that we could be doing things that are more inclusive for people.
I think it's actually, I mean, the CV, I think it's really good indication usually. So if somebody has a very messy CV, then I think that either they didn't put any effort into it, and then I ask myself why they didn't. And then,
go on.
Yeah. And then if if they have a very good CV and formatting and use nice software to do the layout and so on of the CV, then no, they not only made an effort, but also they're disciplined, they're conscientious, and they can express themselves in written form, which is something very valuable.
Yeah, I suppose I agree with that. However, I'm going to fight you on this. Mm-hmm. If you're using a recruiter, sometimes those recruiters format the CV and they do it incorrectly. I do like to not format a CV. I'll share it as it is, because I think what you've said is completely true. Also, sometimes you convert to PDF and it screws it all up, doesn't it?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, I've got a CV template that I share with people. If you'd like a copy, just let me know. That I share with people that, you know, everything's set out and it's working in this environment. Since COVID, I've it's had nothing but praise and I'm so proud of it. It's just moving things around a little bit. And I think also not necessarily within data science, but we need to think about people who have got potentially learning disabilities, people who are neurodivergent, et cetera,
true.
Yeah. So there is a place for it at the moment. I don't know what we're going to put in its place. So it's still going to be there. But I just think from a recruiter point of view, I rarely look at a CV. I will talk to, obviously, that I need to know that you can do the skills that I'm going to talk to you about. It's about that conversation. It's about how well they come back to me. It's about, you know, as you said, the discipline, et cetera. Their answers that they give, how kind they are, goes a long way.
Sure.
No mm-hmm. ego, you know, all of those things.
Openness, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. All of those things I take into account when I'm putting somebody forward for a position, because they're important. Those are important things, not just what is written on that paper.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you only find certain things on a CV. I think for filtering in the beginning, it's important to have a CV.
Yeah, you've got to start somewhere.
But yeah, it only can tell you that much. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, so here comes the question of the podcast.
Oh, wow.
So we have billionaires in this world that I don't think should be there. Do you think that they can, or maybe already have started to build or have built, a supervillain with their money that's going to take over the world?
A supervillain? Or a machine that the destruction machine or something.
However you decipher the question is up to you. How are we going to stop them?
Okay.
Uh-huh. And what is their punishment going to be? So tell me first of all, what are you thinking when I say like an evil supervillain?
Yeah, I think of James Bond probably, and somebody is trying to. Like saw them through or shoot them with a laser or something.
Yep.
The James Bond obviously is going to be shot, but I think that we actually live in times where it's often forgotten, perhaps, that we live in a time where we have more equality than ever before. If you compare any previous times, I mean, people, they may romanticize with the medieval ages or something, whether they would be knights or kings or something. No, they would probably be peasants and be tortured and have bad backs and die with 25 from a cold.
Scurvy.
Or something. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's the differences between between incomes and between the wealth of different people has diminished so much. Even over the 20th century, even I think in the last 10 years has augmented a little bit, but generally it's getting better a lot. So there are of course people who are getting really rich. So Elon Musk, I think, is on a way to become the first trillionaire, I think, in modern history. I think there was this Mali King who maybe was similar, take inflation into account, also a trillionaire or something. But so he'll also at one point he'll suffer a setback one of his companies will go bankrupt, or he'll get a serious penalty from
the fraud, his taxes,
fraud trial, something like that, exactly. Maybe at some point, he doesn't have a lot of income, nominally at least, right? He has just his stocks that are in some fund or something, there's a lot of fraud, obviously. People have been hiding their tax incomes, and big companies have been hiding it. Apple still has billions, hundreds of billions, I think, hidden somewhere in Ireland, I think, and can't access it to make investments. I'm not sure they've resolved that situation. So there are a lot of problems, but I think it's actually getting better, and that's something, to really think about, rather than thinking about the doom and gloom. At the moment we have maybe other crises coming in the United Kingdom with perhaps Brexit hitting harder than even more with COVID. But it's all it will all pass, I think. That's my opinion anyway.
I think it will all pass, and we will deal with it because we have to, and we do as humans. That's just how it is. We will get on with it, as we do with hurdles that come in our lives.
I mean, the ups and downs, and hopefully the long-term trajectory is positive. And
absolutely.
So far it looks like it.
Cool. Thank you so much, Ben. So lastly, I'd like to give you the chance to plug something. If you've got anything you'd like to talk
thank you
about.
Much. Oh, that's cool. So I'd like to plug my book that's just out. It came out a month ago. Machine Learning for Time Series with Python. Check it out. It had two reviews, I think, this morning. I'm checking all the time if anybody asks.
Yeah, I do with the podcast. Please leave a review, everybody. If you listen to this podcast, you like it, leave a review. Also, I will link your book into the show notes so people can have a look.
Thank you much. That's cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. So when did you write it? Talk more.
So I think I started in March. And I was just really interested in time series, how we can use time series more at Love Holidays to avoid having such a long lag often in its predictions. So we talked about correlations rather than causations. You get into the problem that you look at past data and you can't really you're always behind the curve. You're making decisions based on long time ago. So time series has so many different applications that are very cool, and so many different techniques. And some of them are not really talked about in other books. So I just found it very interesting to explore that whole field.
I love that you've written a book.
Oh, thank you much.
bravo, Ben. Okay, as I said, I'll link it in the show notes. Everyone, please go and check that out. I'm going to have a look in a second. But Ben, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a really lovely conversation. It's been lovely to meet you.
Oh, yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, it was very nice talking to you, Wendy.
No problem. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.